Okay, tonight's class is called Breaking Barriers: Israel's Trailblazing Female Tank Units Battle Against Terrorism. All right, so without further ado, let's get into the video. And then we'll take a and then we'll at some point we'll take a break to take a class photo, and we will re
All the terrorists that tried to attack my soldiers and my unit, they are not with us today. Some of them was very close to me, so probably they saw that I'm a woman, and probably they won't get their 72 virgins because I'm a woman.
This is Lieutenant Colonel Or Ben Yehuda of the Israeli Defense Forces, and she is describing how her all-female unit killed more than 100 Hamas terrorists. The mother of three is in charge of tank crews at the Karakal Battalion, who have become legendary after they proved beyond doubt on October the 7th that women can serve alongside men in frontline combat.
Are you married? Do you have a partner? Or
Yeah.
what does he and what do your children say?
So he's also right now at Gaza, and the children, they are with the grandfathers. I think that they are very proud. When I came home, since the beginning of the fight, they told me, "Mommy, we saw you in TV. You became famous." So I hope that they are proud.
The unit is based in southern Israel, and when Hamas fighters streamed across the border from Gaza, they were one of the first IDF units to respond. In the early hours of October 7, as Hamas fighters stormed into Israel using bulldozers to smash through fences, many of the Karakal Brigade were at home on well-earned leave. But within minutes of getting alarm calls from commanding officers, they raced into action and sped to their base, knowing they had not a moment to lose.
At October 7th, I got called from one of my commanders in the north. He told me that they can hear a red code alert, and lots of bomb and rockets everywhere. Some of them just bombed in the base. He called me again and asked me to help him and his soldiers at Sufa base. It's near Kibbutz Sufa. And we all knew our mission. Our mission is to defend the civilians over our area. And we drove over there. And when we came over there, we saw and we also hear lots of bomb and rockets and also guns and shooting everywhere and grenade. That's the moment I realized that this is something big. Lots of terrorists that attack this base and also all the kibbutzim nearby Gaza, and our mission was to stop them over there.
Once there, they spotted the gaping holes in the fences and terrorists swarming through, hundreds of them. The unit had their orders and they followed them to the T, eliminating the terrorists with gunfire and tank rounds, and in some cases, even running over them with their 65-ton tanks. Through a 17-hour tank battle, the women fought off terrorists at kibbutz near Sufa and Holit in southern Israel, killing 100 of them and not sustaining any casualties amongst themselves. The area was eventually cleared when members of the Navy Special Forces unit arrived to join the battle, but by then, most of the bloody work had been done by the women.
We were stronger. We surprised them. The reason that there was a big success because none of them expect us to came out from our bases with the tanks and all that surprised them.
We're going to take a pause. Okay, we're going to take our. Okay, so you watched a basic clip of the women who found themselves on the front lines. I don't know if you guys are familiar with they were originally stationed facing Egypt. It was supposed to be a very quiet Yontif day. They're just like, you know, two tanks facing Egypt, and they get the call of all these marauding terrorists coming into the kibbutzim, and these women knocked out between 50 and 100 terrorists, saved humongous amount of lives. And I don't know if that clip, we got to that part of the clip, but they had weapon systems in their tanks that they were never trained on. And they had to, on the fly, learn how to use some of the particular weapon systems in their Merkava tanks. Because what their jobs they were doing, they didn't need to have full, I don't know why they didn't learn all the stuff, but but these women did it. So what character traits stand out about these 20-year-old women? Most of them were, the older one is, that was, she was a commander, but of the two tanks, the average age is about 20. What are the character traits that stand out, these women?
You're great. Yeah.
Right. So there's a courage there, there's a grit, well, this was the first time, years of the first. Until October 7th, there had been no all-female tank unit that was involved in real combat ever in all of human history. These women, it was not the design. They weren't going to do that. They were playing a more of a backup role, whatever. And then they have changed the equation because basically they demonstrated, just need some plates.
Go downstairs and get some plates for
I'll pause. Historically, Israel did not use women soldiers in combat. That was a relatively recent phenomenon. Not, I mean, sometimes they found themselves in combat, but they weren't in the frontline combat. And then, yes, Ilya, question.
Well, there's
Yeah. Yes.
neutralized
Right.
and
Sexually assaulted is a nice way of saying it.
they also like cut off their, you know,
right.
genitals and so on. I mean, like their bodies
Mutilated.
mutilated them.
Sorry, they really need for
So Israel passed a law that said that females, soldiers, or any female type of supporting units had to be a certain amount of distance from the front line at all times.
Right.
And only recently.
Right. They changed over. They allowed women to be in fighter jets, and this was the first time that women were involved in tanks. But they had never seen they'd never seen co combat. So just so the qualities that they had was, of course, courage, because they could have freaked out because there are people there with RPGs and machine guns and grenades. And I don't know if you saw. Not that they could, that the terrorists could not neutralize it. There was a tank, basically, there was one sole tank.
How did they know that it's women from far away?
They didn't.
Oh, they just
They didn't
didn't
know. These
see.
guys, they just went, or the women got their order, and they just went. And they and like they and there were sometimes there were terrorists. They just ran them over. They just ran them over. And there's outboard machine gun, and they're shooting it, and they're just knocking down these guys. And cause them to think, and then of course they had gone to the into one of the kibbutzim, which had been infiltrated by a thing, and they're involved with together with the special forces to try to get these guys out. So it's an amazing thing, and I mean, you don't know how you get what they call in the Rega Shel Emet, called the moment of truth. How you gonna perform? Now you might say, well, of course, if I'm gonna be there, I'm gonna be amazing, right? Meanwhile, you could have all freaked out, but they didn't. So they had courage, they had stamina, they had grit, everything you mentioned. And they just and what do you think were people's expectations given that these were very young women, in addition, ones who had no experience in any real combat? What would most people imagine would have been the outcome with these the situation?
it, they would have had terrible casualties. It would have been worse than, like, the, you know, the male units.
Well, here's something I learned. That in World War II, only, and most wars,
yes,
only about 10 to 20% of the soldiers actually are doing the shooting.
Well, you have all the support. You have the people, the trucks, no, or the engineering.
They just don't have the courage to kill another human being.
So you're saying that even when people in infantry, people shut down, they get nervous,
All
right, so that just makes it strengthen the case. Okay, so the point is that you know, we're blessed and honored to have these women. I don't know, you know, 2, 3, 4 tanks that came up and stepped up at the moment of truth when basically the IDF and in a certain sense the state of Israel was not functioning for at least 8 hours. And as such, they basically held off what could have been if they did not do what they did.
The right place at the right time.
And they had a male commander told them to go, and they're going on the highway, which is against regulation, whatever, all these different things. And they just did it. And they learned a new weapon thing. They were able to accomplish it. So learning on the fly, courage. There's hundreds of they're shooting everywhere. You're having the tremendous fog of war. And they just did an unbelievable job. And that's, of course, the whole world took notice because they were historical figures. Okay? So we'll agree that these are historical women who played an unbelievable. And then when he asked them, you know, I don't know if you got this part of the clip, did you feel what you did was historical? And what did they say? I don't know if you caught that part of the clip.
They probably thought everybody was doing that.
No, they said, no, we're just doing our job. We were trained to do something, and that's it. We're not, we're not trained to bury her. We just did our job.
They were humble.
We did our job. They were humble. They were courageous. Welcome, Jamie. See you. Okay. We are happy to hear. We're happy you're here. Okay. So now I'm going to tell you a story which you probably have never heard of. So, at MG, you're very familiar with Rabbi Soloveitchik, but there's a story of his life in Boston as a rabbi in the 1930s. So I'm just going to read it out while you guys are enjoying your sushi. So, because you guys do eat, and I'll do the reading. Here we go. It's called the Boston Kashrut Scandal. The Rav, that's how we refer to him, was soon caught up in the vexations and burdensome quests of the American Orthodox rabbinate in this period. Boston had long experienced disputes among its rabbis in the areas of kashrut supervision. The new rabbi not only endured these difficulties, but also encountered resentment of some of the older, elder rabbis of the greater Boston area because of his attempt to establish higher kashrut standards and the Rav's upgrading of conditions of the shochetim, those people who do the ritual slaughtering. There was opposition to the humane conditions from the proprietors of the kosher meat and poultry industries who resented the expense would incur by implementing Rabbi Soloveitchik's regulations. The simmering resentment later became a source of acute pain and distress for the Rav. In 1939, the Rav acceded to the request of the representatives that he reorganized the organization. Exploited by their employers, the shochetim were paid meager salaries and made to work for long hours. Some worked 24 hours at a stretch, and under these conditions, the slaughtering rituals could not be executed properly. As part of his reformation of the Shechita process in Boston, Rav insists that the use of kosher bands of rings or rings on poultry slaughtered by the reorganized shochetim under his supervision. These bands indicated that the poultry was kosher and also minimized the possibility of fabrications. The expense of these bands, 1 cent per fowl, was borne by the proprietors and not by the consumers. In the 1941, accusations were made against the Rav that he was personally reaping monetary gain from the system at the expense of the Jewish community. In addition, the Rav was accused of not declaring this income and therefore of tax evasion. Charges were brought to the attention of the Attorney General of Massachusetts, Robert T. Bushnell. At his behest, Judge Abraham K. Cohen investigated the charges. After a meticulous 14-month investigation of the entire kosher poultry industry, the judge totally cleared the Rav. With a sense of deep indignation, Judge Cohen declared that the charges against Rabbi Soloveitchik were totally untrue and sheer fabrications. Moreover, he declared that the who originated these charges knew they were unfounded. Evil rumors were spread with malice, and the rabbi was dreadfully abused and basically accused. Judge Cohen stated that the general kosher situation in Boston was a disgrace to its Jewish community. he cited a letter from Swift and Company, which declared that during the 9 years that Rabbi Soloveitchik had supervised the kosher production, it was with scrupulous integrity, unquestioned probity, and carried out with rare efficiency. Okay, so this is Rabbi Soloveitchik, a young guy here. He's basically in his 20s. He's a new rabbi in town, and he comes there, and he's trying to accomplish two things: increase the kashrut in Boston.
How was the Jewish?
No, I mean the big Jewish community. Not that many observe. You know, a lot of traditional Jews. There weren't that many Shomer Shabbos, but people ate, but a lot more people kept kosher and would only eat kosher products. Exactly. Right. So they all ate kosher. You know what I mean? So he comes in there. And basically, the proprietors of the various poultry thing were basically abusing the shochet, basically making them work long hours. And he created sort of a union, which of course did not make him beloved to the companies. And he also said, "We have to up the kosher standards in order to make it very clear those people part of my circle of shochetim will put this band on, and you got to pay for it." So basically, what happened was that the companies, what do? They claimed that he is ripping off, he is doing this whole system, so he will become rich on the backs of the Jewish community of Boston. And they said they basically told the officials that he's engaged in tax evasion because he's making all this cash and he's not declaring it. Okay, so basically they threw him to the threw him under the bus. So this is very serious. So who does an investigation? The Attorney General of the state of Massachusetts. They do a 14-month investigation, and essentially and basically showed out that all the claims were false, and all of that. They said they knew it was false. They're just trying to rub them out like a mafia. In other words, so here's the question: why would they want to do that?
It's tort. They want to make sure that there's no tort involved with money.
Let's wait. He's trying to let's back up. Why is Rabbi Soloveitchik doing all this?
For halacha.
Right, but for two halachic expressions. One is that the food is that the meat is actually kosher, and B, that the shochetim who are working in the slaughterhouses are not abused by the companies. So, I mean, how did the companies like that? They did not like that because he's costing them more money because his higher standards are costing them more money. He's costing money in two. What are the two ways he's costing them money?
Wages,
because he's saying you can't just make these guys work like slaves 24 hours in a row.
Lower your house rent.
Right, so you're gonna have to have hire more workers, or it's gonna cost you more money.
It's gonna be
more time, less product, and you gotta pay the people at base rate. And only that—that's on the worker side. What about the kashrut side?
How do they know that slaughter isn't
correct? So also by the fact that the shochetim that he's doing has the ring around the around the chicken. So basically, and who has to pay for those rings around the chicken? The companies. So basically the companies did not like this guy. He's costing them money on the less product, more expensive, plus the additional kosherist supervision stamps, rings.
But if they wouldn't get him,
they don't care. It's about the money. It's about the Benjamins. It's not about the money. It's not about the kosher. It's not about treating people properly. Well, that's what he's with Rabbi Soloveitchik trying to do. He's coming into town as a younger, and there's a lot of people who are called rabbi, where a rabbi, was more like a cantor. You know what I'm saying? Like many people who are cantors are not really rabbis. And running a a mechanized industrial consciousness is a very complicated thing. So also, so he's ruffling everybody's feathers. The old guard is not like, who is this young brash guy changing the rules? The only people who like him are the Shokuten, because basically they're finally not getting messed over, abused, thank you. And the company's on. So therefore, he's standing up to these guys. Yeah, well, you can stand up to the company. What is the company going to do? They're going to put forth a couple of frivolous lawsuits to try to crush you, basically wear you down. So what happened? So they did the investigation, 14 months. And not only that, I didn't write down, I couldn't put all the quote over the. Not only that, not only they're not involved in tax evasion, it came out and they did went through all of his taxes and all of his cash. He was they owed him another a larger refund. He was owed more money back from the state of Massachusetts because they did an audit and he overpaid his taxes. So the bottom line was, but for 14 months being in a litigation situation. When you're under the thing, and not only that, people are making these claims in the press and everything. So basically, Rabbi Soloveitchik's name was basically garbage. Damage was enormous. So here's the question: how was Rabbi Soloveitchik courageous in the situation, and what would a lesser rabbi have done in such a situation?
I'm going to stand up for what's right.
Do you know how much money that he got in addition for being a rabbi for doing all this kashrus work? So he wasn't any making any money, and he got nailed for it, which gets to stand that. So question number 7, why does doing justice for the weak so often demand great courage?
They're antagonizing forces. The company was the companies, producing the meat and all that were definitely an antagonizing force. So it's often the case that happens. So
in other words, if you're going to have the weak being abused, they're going to be abused by a more powerful abuser. So if you were going
to. Who knows full well that they're abusing also.
Correct.
So they're going to be. They can't retaliate and they're strong because.
So therefore, if you're going to be involved in that, you are going to require great courage and fortitude for you to stand up to them.
It's also just human nature to not want to get involved in something that doesn't affect you. And so if you're not weak and vulnerable or poor, then it's difficult to get involved because you don't have skin in the game.
Yes, and that is why we're now with this introduction. You now appreciate why Moshe Rabbeinu was selected to be the first Jewish leader. Let's read. All right, Bakasha, Adrian, at your last time before you go off to sunny Florida, the baby. And in those days.
In those days, Moshe grew up and went out to his brothers. And saw their burdens, and he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man of his brothers. He turned this way and saw that there was no man, and he struck the Egyptian and buried him in the sand.
Stop right there. Moshe Rabbeinu, around 20 or 25 years old, prince of Egypt, goes out and he sees a Jewish slave getting beaten, maybe mercilessly, by an Egyptian. What would a regular person, if you're a prince of Egypt, what would you do?
Go back to your giant palace and pick wine, eat grapes, and
that's what somebody's Egyptian. It's like, you're doing here.
Yeah,
right.
Or get hand me another whip.
Yeah.
Right. So you're certainly not going to help the person. You're part of the establishment. You're part of the state. He is, in fact, and so this guy, maybe the slave deserve to be beaten to the edge of his life. So the fact is, he saw that, he turned, and then he killed the Egyptian and saved the Jew, first of all shows A, he still identified as a Jew. Two, he at tremendous personal peril put his neck out because he's killing a member of the of the government. Of his brothers. Notice he calls. He strikes because he saw that among that he saw that this Egyptian's kid, this fact he views this person as one of his brothers, indicates that verse is not saying because you saw he saw an Egyption beating beating a Jew, a Jewish
But
person.
even if
This
it
is a,
wasn't a Jew, even if it was a Mongolian, but he was a slave, and then the Egyptian is beating the
we're going
Mongolian.
to get to that. Hold on, we're going to get to that. All right, keep on reading. Keep on.
So he went out on the second day, and behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to the guilty one, "Why do you strike your fellow?" He said, "Who set you as chief and judge over us? You intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And Moshe was afraid and said, "Indeed, the matter is known. Pharaoh heard of this matter and sought to kill Moshe. But Moshe fled from before Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian. And he sat down by the well. And the priests of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water. And they filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, and Moses rose and saved them and watered the flock. They came to their father, Reuel, and he said, 'Why have you come so quickly today?' And they said, 'An Egyptian man delivered us from the hand of the shepherds, and moreover, he even drew water for us and watered the flock.'"
There's three episodes here. There's killing the Egyptian, him getting involved between the two Jews fighting, and then of course rescuing the Midianite women. So let's go to the second one. So why is he getting involved with the two Jews fighting? He says, went to the guilty one. Says, "Why do you strike your fellow?" What elements about the personality? What elements about the personality do you see about Moshe, or is the Torah trying to depict us? He identifies as a member of the Jewish people. That goes to the first case where he basically sees.
Maybe he wanted to make peace, but like he's coming from a place of like trying to mediate the fight and to resolve the dispute.
Correct.
Not to try to make him feel bad, but rather for like
And how was that met with? How
anger
did
and
the two Jews who were fighting respond to that?
frustration and like telling your business.
Who set you as a chief and judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? And that's a cra that is not crazy. Isn't that crazy? Why would they assume that? In other words, they should view him as a great redeemer. He, as an Egyptian prince, backed protected the Jew. They should say, "You're why would he assume that they're going to kill the Jews?" In other words, he seems to be a ally of the Jewish people. Why
But
they
they
see.
know that he would never like kill a Jew. They know it because they probably
Yeah,
know it.
so why are they accusing him of that? Why are they
They're
going crazy?
mocking him because they know they're infected.
He also said that he's capable of killing.
It's
So if he's
true.
capable of killing one person, he can kill another person.
Okay.
But he would not do it to his fellow people because he protected the Jew. So they know because he protected the Jew that he would not kill a Jew.
But you see that but you see they don't have a great love to for them.
Right. They
Yeah.
don't like him, but
Can you give me like the timeline of like when did Moses like realize he was Jewish?
Okay, that's a good question.
Because
So
like I feel like he just
all
like
right, let's back up. Back up. So let's we last we he the prior story is that Moshe Rabbeinu is born during the decree that all the boys are going to be thrown to the Nile. Mom tries to hide him at home. Mom's name is. Moshe's mom's name? Yocheved, excellent. Thank you, Jamie. Yocheved, and basically her strategy is, I'm going to put the baby in the by the reeds near the Nile River, and I'm going to have my older daughter Miriam watch the baby. As we know, we discussed this prior, that she had with this arm stretching midrash, that basically she's there, and then the daughter of Paro sees her, sees him, and for all kinds of possible reasons falls in love with him and adopts him. But then she says she knows she can't nurse him. But then Miriam said, "Well, do you need a wet nurse?" And then basically she brought Yocheved, picked up the baby, and Moshe spent the next couple of years, they nursed at least a 2 or 3 or 4 years at home. So he knew that he knew where his family was. He knew that he's a Jew. Or he went, but remember, while he's being weaned, he knows that these are his family. Miriam's his sister, Aaron's his older brother, Yocheved is his mom, Amram's his dad. And then when he's finished weaning, she drops him off on a obviously a very difficult day, and he now joins the Egyptian royal family, but he knows he's of Jewish origin. He just has to look, he has a bris milah. He knows that he's different. He's told he's different. And that explains why. Why does when Paro finds out want to kill him? I mean, just because if Paro, if regular prince would have killed an underling, you think you think that do you think that if Paro would care? Why Paro says he found out about this and he wanted to kill Moshe. Why? Well, that's a crazy reaction.
I think because one of his people was killed.
Yeah, but what are
Why
we
he's
just?
killing my people?
But he's also part of the people. In other words, he's his grandson. Moshe is Paro's adopted grandson. Ah.
He was raised at the palace. He was raised as the grandson.
Biologically, he wasn't.
But it wasn't so much biologically. I'm certain that Pharaoh probably gave him less to
Yes.
him. But he was raised as an Egyptian and his oldest brother being with him and behaving as one Egyptian should, he would probably be very safe and he would have a very comfortable life.
Agreed.
However, because he killed an Egyptian, Pharaoh, if any other prince killed anyone beneath him, it would have, that society would have.
Exactly.
They could kill any person they like, and
You're above the law.
no one would criticize. But because he was Jewish, I know to be Jewish, they probably would have seen his killing an Egyptian over a Hebrew slave as a complete betrayal. Thus, everything that he was taught and brought up with in an Egyptian court was nullified by the act of him saving the slave over the
Jamie,
Egyptian.
excellent, excellent, excellent thought.
I
Excellent
think.
thought. Let me just put that down because I'm not going to pick that up on the recording. I just want to just share. Jamie made the following insight. He said like this: if Moshe had been a biological Egyptian prince and he killed an underling, since the royal family are above the law, then he would find no, there'd be no retribution. Ah, but basically, what Jamie's saying that Moshe was given a provisional status. If you live the life and you're fully committed to being an Egyptian, fine. But the fact that you killed an Egyptian to protect a Jew indicates fundamentally you're not an Egyptian. And worse, we have trained the future redeemer because you have all the skills of being a prince, a leader in Egypt, because you have the benefit of the royal court and all the education. So now you go from a favored grandson prince to a threat to the empire. And now you are a better your traitor, and that's why Moshe becomes a fugitive.
I don't know if it's necessarily personal and
No,
betrayal.
it's not personal.
It's
Not personal.
sounds to me like the course
Okay, how so?
where in the beginning where what's the name of the queen? I'm blanking.
Avashi.
She doesn't show up, and the king is like, "No, what's going to happen now? Like, women are going to start rebelling."
Well, that was well, Chazal say that was Haman as an advisor's suggestion.
Well, I think the same thing might be happening here. The fact that Moshe, part of the royal family, is killing an Egyptian to protect a Jew, it's just throwing off
The whole balance of
the
power.
balance of
Right.
power.
I don't, Jim, you know, was not, you know, our
It's a
power was not,
political
it was a
issue.
political, yeah, it was not, she nothing betrayal that he was personally offended. First of all, he probably was also personally offended, but we're talking about, in addition to that, that there was also like recognized objectively, politically, we have a massive problem. And this is going to be a
I think
tremendous.
this brings us to another point. The other point is that if you're a Jew, no matter how much you try to become someone else, or even if you're raised in a house that's not like complete stranger, like as an Egyptian or as an American or as whatever, or as a German or whatever, you're
Still
never
a Jew.
you're gonna
You're
be a
always a
Jew
Jew.
no matter what.
Yes,
And
that is a.
the people who try to convert from
You can
Judaism
hide. You can. You
and they try to like
try to hide. You can
shift
try to
back their
run.
identity or whatever. It haunted them even more, the fact that they were Jewish, and then they ended up coming back to Judaism. And
That is.
so
That's. And I
that
know.
everything that was said leads to the fact that, look, Moshe was born Jewish,
Brought up
but
in a.
brought up completely Egyptian,
Egyptian in the
but
Egyptian court.
he still was like held up for being Jewish and came back to being Jewish.
That's correct.
And so
On the other end, that people hate you. You don't care how Jewish you are as long as you're Jewish.
that's what I'm saying. That, no, that, they
That's
will
correct.
still hate you even if you're the most American. No, I'm not American. I wouldn't say American. I would say whatever. Any nationality.
Now, but see, but the picture of Moshe is a little more complex because he had the last case. He's by the well. He's in Midian. These women, Midianite women, these are idolatrous pagan women, are they're it's their turn to they're drawing water. And what happens? These other guys push them out of the way, basically harass them. And then what does Moshe do? He rises up, he protects them, he pushes them away, and then gives the women water. So you see what do you that's a very important story. Why? First of all, why did he get involved? He's an outsider. He's an Egyptian. He's out by the well. Why is he none of his, in other words, these squabbles in Midian, why that's, is that his problem? Why is he getting his nose? Why is he getting up in their grill? And why is it his problem?
Why do you even do that?
Why do you even do that? They're not Jewish,
And he's
so
not a judge. Not like
he's
he's
nobody.
not like an authority that could
He's
cover
not
for
anybody.
abuse.
He's not anybody. Yeah, you have a. Okay. Okay, fine. So we'll. How much longer can you stay? Okay, fine. Okay, good.
Like your cost benefit.
Okay, fine. All
Yeah.
right, good. All right, thank you. All right. So, take your man, Flakaraba. So the key element here, the
Good
Cree.
travel.
Best of luck.
Best of luck to you.
Adrian, you move into Florida. Okay, back to the class. So the thing is that you see from this, Moshe was concerned about justice. And justice is not just justice for a Jew, it's justice for all people. He saw women being abused. He didn't stop and say, one second. Are you which tribe are you from? No.
Same. Yeah, he
No.
doesn't care.
Doesn't care. An injustice is an injustice because basically Moshe, whatever his education was, it was that he became an Ish Tzedek, person who's concerned about justice. And
Right.
these people being beaten upon, in other words, they were clearly, he watched the whole situation.
But he took the law into his hands.
But there's obviously there is no there's a
Like,
lawless.
if I'm seeing God forbid him and him fighting, and I'm like, stop fighting, right? And then I get involved in the fight, and I'm like, I can maybe try and make peace, but like at the end of the day,
Okay, so you're right. So you're looking at that from a contemporary lens when you have a thing called a police force. But in the ancient world, and he looked around, obviously, if there were people who, if there were judges and law enforcement that could take care of the situation, is one thing. But he saw there's nobody helping these women. They're just basically these women, because they're weaker, are being taken advantage of. And he sprung into action. So. That is a key feature of Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, here's my question. When Moshe left Egypt, why did not he start a resistance movement, outside of Egypt to go in and try to, get the Jews to overthrow or sneak out or.
and also like
There's always, it's always, there's always rebellions. Or to try to sneak in, or like a guerrilla, go in back. What? God has not spoken to him. This is all done. God has not spoken a word to him.
Or
the burning bush.
Yeah.
Badly. Yeah, many years. No, longer. He gets burning bush at age 80. He's now around 25. So the bottom line is that when he saw that the guys turned on him, he's trying to help two Jews. And they immediately say, "What, do you kill us?" They kill the Egyptian. He saw that fundamentally that they felt more a kinship with their Egyptian, Egyptian leaders and system than they did with him who trying to help them out. But he basically felt
they knew that he was Jewish.
Yes, of course. And the truth is that basically he had basically done what? Wiped his hands. You know, I can't help these people. In other words, because basically what they endangered him. How did they endanger him? By letting it either overtly telling the authorities or letting their schmooze go out. And who was the one who told? The guy who saved. It's the most shocking fact, because in the story that if you read carefully. Well, that's the next day. The first day, it's one. It's just there's Egyptian guy, taskmaster, the victim, and Moshe. Nobody there. So it had to be the guy he saved. He started. He blabbed that. Oh my! You'll never believe what happened. That Moshe, the prince of Egypt, killed an Egyptian, and by doing so, putting him under tremendous threat. And it was because basically Paro wanted to kill him. That's a midrash. That's a midrash. That's not the flame shot. That's a deep idea. What's meant by that? The plane, though, he killed them with like a stone some rock. He killed them in an aggressive, normal way. So basically, the same guy who he saved ran on. So basically, the reason why he didn't try to organize a rebellion is because these people are not worthy of it. They're not worthy. They're not. They're on a low level. It was a bad moment that he basically.
Saved him and then he ran.
Yeah, I know. It's unbelievable. Now, here's question number 7. How do you know that Moshe's intolerance of injustice went beyond Jewish people? We just pulled that. How were Rabbi Soloveitchik and the female tank unit like Moshe? You want to add more than one word? Yeah. Yes, and? Yes, and?
Yeah. And they probably thought that there would be consequences, although they probably didn't know the full extent of it, but they went along anyway.
That's it. Both Rabbi Soloveitchik, he did what was right, he made no money off it, he knew that if he was going to get these people upset, it might have come back to bite him. The female tag unit, they went, they saw that their fellow Jews were getting butchered. And even though they're going to go, they're going into the battle, into harm's way, and they knew they were not veteran tank, specialists. They were learning on the fly, but they had to do it. Even if they and they knew one thing, like every soldier who goes into battle as a member of the IDF, you're going into battle. You know that you may not come back, but they're going in. Because they know that the Jewish people needs them. Right? Salvation is another kind of battle. It wasn't a war of war, but you know, the Jewish people need to eat kosher food. And the shochetim who are being abused and make to do 24-hour shifts and be paid meager wages, that's an injustice. You have to step up for that. If you're not stepping up for justice, you're not a good Jew. That's what it is. So Moshe Rabbeinu is identified as we see the he's a guy who is concerned deeply about justice, and the Ralbag puts down three things. Number one, protecting your fellow Jew. I'll read the Hebrew here. To all the Revihu b'midot, who shall royal adam shiashgiach b'mnei amo v'yariv v'yivam b'masha nasa lehem me'achamad. See a fellow Jew being hurt, you got to step up for them. Otira, you see, kimosher b'inu l'chosek r'sonu riv ben Yisrael. He fought the battle of a fellow Jew. Shara hamash, ayu mitzri yoseh. He saw that the Egyptians doing violence to him. Kamala v'hika nasho. And he killed them. Sam nasho b'zeh b'sakanat tumah. He put himself in profound and extreme danger, until he got to the point where he had to run away from town. That's a level. That's a very high level. That's why it's a Moshe Rabbeinu level. Two, stopping violence in society. A person who's perfected, you should stop violence to anybody who's being victimized, Jew or non-Jew, to the extent that you can. See that these tremendous qualities of an absolute commitment to truth and doing that is really the qualities of what? That he will become a prophet. A prophet. These are the qualities of an absolute dedication to principle, regardless of the consequence, is really a prerequisite for being a prophet. Last, protect the weak and the vulnerable. It's critical for a person to motivate yourself to help people who are weak and vulnerable, and to save for those who are oppressing them. Because they don't have any power themselves. They can't protect themselves. That opens Yashlim. And that's critical for a vibrant, successful society. This way, everybody can help each other out. Everybody takes care of the poor and the vulnerable, therefore they will be able to be successful. Miyad, goes on. That's why Moshe helped out all the daughters of Yitro. Miyad. Okay. All right. So do you see Moshe's greatness and why he selected is because he was courageous, because he stood up, he spoke truth to power. He endangered himself to this great extent. This is a very high level. These are the stepping stones, the leadership, but of the highest order, why he became a Navi and became the leader of the Jewish people. Now, put three practical scenarios, a little more practical, and then we'll go down for our photo. Scenario number two, one, Jane Amgier navigates the fashion world's clash with her Jewish values of modesty. Yet she grapples with a dichotomy between her upbringing, which emphasized modesty and humility, and the allure of contemporary fashion, which often celebrates boldness and exposure. Like that? Boldness and exposure. Struggling between fitting in and staying true to herself, she seeks a balance by blending contemporary trends with her faith principles. What would the woman from the tank unit advise her to do? She's navigating. This is not so simple. So, in order, for example, it's easy to do that when it's the wintertime. Not so much when it is in July. Or you can't tell somebody who's so committed to modesty so much when it's 20 degrees outside. But when it's 80 degrees outside, then it's very obvious if a woman specifically is committed to the principles of modesty. So, and that, by the way, is courageous, because it's not so much. It's because you, to be different. I'm just picking one example, but to be different, discernibly different, or it could be a guy wearing a kippah, or nobody wears a kippah, is extremely, say whatever you want to pick. It's very difficult, and it takes courage, and you have to be sticking to your principles. So, what would the tank unit advise her to do? Right, to the extent, yeah, it's not easy, but it's hard. But
there's a value that I was taught in the military when I served. It's called Emunah B'Tikvah HaDerech, faith in the righteousness of the path.
right.
So, like, you have a certain path that you were trained with, that you were taught, and you have to follow that. I was a Tzamchan, so for the Tzamchanim, this is a big one. Emunah B'Tikvah HaDerech. You have to. No matter what happens,
Trust
you have to.
your training
No matter what
your
happens, right now they kidnap me and they do something to me. I can't give in. I have to stay loyal to my country, to my values, and to my faith.
This is oh that's a much more extreme
It's
circumstance,
extreme, but
but all right, but
so.
lesser I think I can meet with Jane, but I could, or I could be with Joe. These are more contemporary and more moderate, but yet can be very difficult examples of where a person has to be courageous. What are your values? Or I mean, I can make a similar situation is you're invited to a work event and they didn't accommodate with any kosher and everybody's eating and everybody's saying, oh, no, why don't you eat it? It's not so bad. It's not so it's not pork. It's not shellfish. Every person who's encouraging will become an expert of the laws of kosher and encouraging to do that. So to stand down and to say, look, I'm not, it requires courage. There's a lot of courage. Being a Jew demands a measure of courage, period, because you have values which are not necessarily always aligned with the contemporary values. The extreme example we talked about is Moshe Rabbeinu. Another example we learned about with Rabbi Soloveitchik fighting the sort of the system of corrupt system of kashrut that was exists in the 1930s of Boston, or the women who decide to stand up and be courageous against all odds, do that. Okay, scenario number two: Nancy MGR and her husband Brad MGR are looking for various communities to move to. Based on Moshe Rabbeinu, what would you look for in a rabbi? Okay.
Would look for if he protects the weak, if he cares about justice in the community,
Yeah.
if he looks out for his people.
Right. That, in other words, not just simply if he gives a good cheer and a good lecture and a good thing, but are people who are vulnerable in the community being taken care of? That's a very important. Or is the person concerned about not just chesed for the rich people, but chesed for the poor people? Lastly, Stacey MGR heard her buddy Tanya had gotten divorced and is really depressed. Stacey calls to cheer her up and figure out what she can be helpful. That means that Stacey quickly, that's not Becky, Stacey. Quickly, I made a mistake. Quickly realized that Tanya's financially very vulnerable, seeking help. Next day, Tanya calls three times. Stacey wonders if she should not take the call to start disengaging for her. What would most people do? What would the woman from the tank unit suggest she should do?
Like maybe either financially or to fundraise or I don't know, recommending an inter pro bono attorney or whatever, might
What would
be
most, we'll start with first. What would most people do? What? Except I'm remembering the calls, like this person being a nudgy drag on my life. And the person's going to be a.
most in today's
Yeah.
study here.
This person cannot help me. This person is now needs my help. They're toxic, right? They're a li Are they an asset or a liability?
You're just hitting on my nerves.
They're annoying me, and then I have to go out of my way and help a person who's very vulnerable. So this is a very common example, especially, by the way, in what? Well, that would be a great thing to do. I'm saying what I first thing is, what most people do? Not answering the phone calls and let the problem drift away. Just drift away.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hello.
Hello. Good evening for you.
Yeah.
Good.
Not my problem.
But what would a good Jew do?
Well, that's exactly the point. That if
A good Jew would help.
this is all New York over there, right?
A good Jew would give tzedakah.
But not, it's not just giving them
Emotional support.
yeah, all or tzedakah, everything. The key word for tzedakah is we've learned in different class, v'chazakta bo, strengthen them, whatever they need, emotional strength. Advice, financial support, and step into the breach, and not like basically not my problem. So basically, to put the whole class into a thing, we'll go downstairs for another picture. Is that that from the examples of the women tank unit, examples of Rabbi Soloveitchik, from the examples of Moshe Rabbeinu, the to be courageous. And to do what's right, which is by definition not going to be popular, which is again, when you're going against forces, either internal forces or external forces, that really is the mark of the true Jew, and that's why Moshe Rabbeinu was selected to be the leader because he had those qualities. He was a man of justice, didn't make any care of a Jew or non-Jew, tried to help out his fellow Jews. They turned on him, they ratted him out. Shocking.
He saved them and they arrested
Yeah.
them.
Yes. Yes, it's unbelievable. So that's why the burning bush, Moshe Rabbeinu, Hashem had said that no, they are worthy of being redeemed. Okay, so this is critical to see that. So this is what leadership is. And every person, every Jew on their own level has to be a leader. You have to be courageous. You have to stick to your values. It's going to be difficult, but we have. But one thing, as a Jew, we are blessed with great examples, past and present, of people who step up. That the reason why those tank members of the tank unit was interviewed by all the press throughout the world. They were shocked that these 20-year-old women, who, against all odds, stood against tremendous forces. And then when they asked, are they here? Says, no, we're just doing what we're trained to do. And they think, and how can we? And in a certain sense, they're basically saying to the interviewer, like, in a certain sense, how can we know? We're gonna sit in our tanks, protected while the yeshivas are being overrun by terrorists, slaughtered, and butchered. Is going to be indifferent to their screams. No, a Jew is not indifferent to a scream. That is basically the message here. All right, guys, Lyle Tov, let's do a little another picture, and we'll call it a night. It was Baruch Hashem.